Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to another episode of the How I Quit Alcohol podcast. For first-time listeners, please be aware that not all of the conversations within this podcast are suitable for children. I'd also like to add a trigger warning that sometimes the conversations can get a little heavy. We may talk about things like sexual abuse, domestic violence, drug use, and alcohol use. And if you feel that that may trigger you, please do not tune in. Also, I'd like to add, if you are a heavy daily drinker, please seek the help of a medical practitioner before quitting alcohol. This podcast comes to you from beautiful Bundjalung country. Please kick back and enjoy, grab yourself your favorite alcohol-free bevy, and if you haven't already, do a gal a favor, please subscribe, rate, and review this podcast.
This podcast is proudly brought to you by Monday Distillery. Monday Distillery is a new age beverage company revolutionising the way we look at having a night out with friends. They make sophisticated, non-alcoholic beverages that are sugar-free and full of social graces. Now you can enjoy a good time, love what you drink, and love yourself the next day too. Stay high in spirits, keep a clear mind. Cheers to Monday. Are you sick of feeling controlled by alcohol? Do you want to drink less? Do you wake up on a Sunday morning feeling really anxious and full of regret? I'm Danny Carr and welcome to my podcast, How I Quit Alcohol.
Hi, and welcome back to How I Quit Alcohol. Today in the Zoom room, I'm joined by the gorgeous, the very colourful Calamity Tash from Adelaide. How are you, Tash?
I'm so well. Hi, Danny. Nice to finally meet you.
I know. This has been a long time coming. Absolutely. I think I say that about every guest. I'm like, it really has this person. But it feels like a long time coming anyway. But thank you so much for coming on. I'm just commenting. People can't see this, but you're surrounded by insanely bright colours. You've got rainbow hair. You've got rainbow coloured clothes on. And I'm wearing, what colour is this? This is like what am I wearing? This
olive? Lemon.
An olive linen shirt and brown cord shorts. We couldn't be more opposite.
I'm used to being the brightest one in the room. I understand.
What's with all the color? Like, this is incredible.
I have always been like this for as long as I can remember. My bedroom, my surroundings, I've always loved the chaos of colour. I've always found it to be really calming and feels like a natural state. And people that know me best know that when I'm in all black top to toe, that don't talk to me. I'm off duty. Don't talk to me.
That's a really great, you can really send that. That would come home strong for people that know you, I'm sure. So you're 4 years and 3 months sober. How old are you, Tash?
I turned 30 this year.
Just turned 30.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. So I think hitting 30 and already being into my sober journey just felt incredible. My 30th milestone felt like a milestone I honestly never really planned to reach. So when I got there and I was thriving in the way that I feel I am now, it was such a tremendous feeling. It was, fantastic.
Wow, that's amazing. So you took up sobriety, I'm guessing then from my calculations, around 26 or 25 and a half years old.
Yes. I think just about to turn 26. I actually met someone who was sober, and I know we all talk about that light bulb moment, but that was it for me. I truly went, oh my God, we can do that. We can just stop. Like, just stop. You know that that's not how it goes, but it had never occurred to me that a younger person, you know, in their 20s could make the choice to be sober and to go into recovery. That felt like something I always told myself I would do when I was older and when I needed to, and when it was really a quote unquote issue, full well knowing that it was already controlling my life. It was very much already an issue, just not one that I was ready to face.
It's so interesting, like you say, oh, right, oh, we can do that. Like, oh, we can do a life without alcohol. Oh, right, didn't know. And often, like, honestly, like, I'd definitely say when I was your age, oh, my God, like, it wasn't even my radar. I didn't even think that that was a possibility. So that's fantastic. When you say you met someone, was it in a, like, lover's capacity, or you just met someone
random? It was in a romantic capacity. But I do think that the situation would have been the same had it just been meeting a sober person, which is why I live my recovery out loud. I talk about it all the time. I mention it all the time. If even somebody watching one story can hear, oh, that bright, colorful, exuberant person chooses a sober life, maybe I too, you know, maybe a queer, bright, exuberant person, maybe I can also be sober. I think it's important to have representations, you know. And what I thought of an alcoholic was, you know, a middle-aged man, or, you know, maybe a person really hard on their luck in, you know, in their late 50s or something. You don't think of a bright, colorful, you know, queer artist. That's not, I know for most people, that's not where we go when we think of addiction, recovery, those kinds of topics. So meeting someone else who was like me and in my age bracket, I could see that it was possible. It gave me hope.
Wow, that's so amazing. And I really love this whole vision of you as well, and just sort of putting it out there that you can live a beautiful, colorful, queer, whatever, just a beautiful, colorful existence.
Yes.
Don't need the alcohol.
Yeah, and I think that was so much a part of that beginning journey, that first year, 2 years, to be honest. I was so concerned that this personality, this person that I am, I was so sure that that was alcohol-based. I was so sure that I could not be outlandish, that I couldn't be loud, that I couldn't be confident, that I couldn't have a good time. I was so sure of those as if they were facts. And as I got further and further into my recovery, you have that realization that you're still a maniac of a person, just in a sober person's body now. And it was actually almost daunting at the beginning. And I thought, oh my God, so you're telling me I'm like this anyway? And it was kind of horrifying at first. But then as I learned true love and true self-acceptance, I am now overjoyed that I get to be this version of myself at full capacity and remember everything, and every interaction is genuine and meaningful and important, as opposed to these throwaway drunken comments that I might, you know, make, or this drunken wisdom that, you know, having D&Ms at the pub. But now everything I do and say is intentional. It has purpose. And I can really show up for the people in my life in a way that I couldn't before. It's a tremendous feeling.
It's amazing. And it's so true. You realize I can still be myself to my fullest capacity, if not more.
More, absolutely.
Yeah, incredible. Tell us a bit about how you got started with alcohol, and tell us a bit about that whole journey. So tell us about, like, take us back to the very first time you drank, and then the progression.
Well, I, as a young person, my parents were both in the wine industry, from both a sales perspective and a graphic design perspective. So from a young age, alcohol around the house, wine specifically, was very, very normalized. Having my sister and I do wine tastings at dinner was very normalized, because, you know, as my father would explain, we are children, so we have different palates. And so we could taste things and pick up on things that adults could not. And this was my you know, dad's well-meaning way of trying to explain developing taste buds and things like that. But I guess it started a really early habit, and I watched the way that the people in my life drank. And at the time, I thought that was normal behavior. And now I see that they do drink in excess. That's not something that they're willing to address, which is its own issue. But yes, I grew up with alcohol being used almost as a coping mechanism. If things are overwhelming, if you are going to events you don't want to go to, what I saw was that you drank to get through those events, and that you drank to put up with people you didn't like. And it seemed to make things better for those people around me. So I witnessed that a lot. And I was aware of the unhealthy alcohol behavior of those around me from a really young age. And I remember being,
How old were you when you were doing these tastings?
Maybe between 10 and 15.
Young.
Yeah. But, you know, very little. It wasn't ever, you know, here's a glass of wine at dinner. Yeah. It was just, we want you to taste this. And what do you think? Or my parents would make cocktail nights, and we would all want a little sip of, you know, what are you trying? And we want to be involved, you know? And so then when I was about, you know, 14, 15, started school, instantly was attracted to the people in school who were maybe a little more of the bad boy types, you know, found myself hanging out with older people from a really young age. I never really related to my peers. I didn't have the same interests. I didn't have the same views or even world experience, life experience. I traveled a lot as a child. My family traveled a lot. I was very, very privileged in that way, but it did mean that I couldn't quite relate to my peers. And so all the older people I was hanging out with were drinking, and, you know, maybe they were 16 and 17. And so giving the 14-year-old a drink really didn't seem like a big deal. And I know immediately, I remember feeling the way that it numbed the anxiety in my brain. That was what was addictive. The addiction was the numbing part. It wasn't the drinking. It wasn't the having fun. It was, when I drink, I don't feel sad. In those early days, at least, you know, I drank my feelings. I drank to cover up any anxiety or, you know, childhood issues. And then as I got older and older, I could see that the way I drank was not the same as the way my peers drank. And, you know, we got to 16, 17, and I started going out to clubs and bars and using fake IDs. And again, my friends would have a few drinks and go home. And I was never, ever satisfied. I could never reach the point I wanted to reach. I was never drunk enough, fun enough, loud enough, late enough. It was never enough. It's a classic tale of addiction. You're constantly chasing the dragon. You're never going to get there. By the time I was 18, I was doing Am I an Alcoholic quizzes online.
Wow.
And scoring in the 90% aisle. And they were saying, you look like someone who needs rehab, you know? And I would share this information with my friends over a drink at the pub, and they would just dumb it down so much. You're 18. You're the life of the party. You're fine, Tash. You're fine. You're fine. You're fine. And that is what everyone saw, that I was fine. You know, as a lot of alcoholics, we hide the true nature of our disease, and a lot of the really bad, sad, awful things happen behind closed doors, not at the pub and not at the party. So I guess I let my friends convince me that I was okay and that it was a party and it was all right. It wasn't until I got to, I would say, my mid-20s, where I would start my day with a pint of wine. I would have wine in a thermos on the bus to take to my office job. I would then leave my office job to go to the pub to drink a liter of wine at the pub at lunch, go back to the office, keep drinking my desk wine, knock off, go back to the pub, then go home, have some more wine, sleep it off, start all day, like again the next day.
Well, yeah, hang on. Constant. Okay. So when you're going to your desk job, your day job, and you're starting the day with wine, like, we have to unpack this, because firstly, did they know that you must have smelt like wine?
I think that. I know that there were one or two of my colleagues who knew, and at the time I was drinking through a very heavy breakup, a very traumatic breakup. I'd moved countries back from the UK back to Australia, so I was very disjointed. There were people in my life who were concerned at this point, and who would outwardly say, you seem to have a problem, or I would openly say, oh, well, I have an issue. Oh, well, I'm an alcoholic, and oh, well, I this and I that. And I would excuse my behavior with putting a label on myself as if that excuses it and makes it okay. I don't know. I know that since then, my boss has been made aware of my behavior since then. I would love to actually talk to them and see what they saw, what they noticed. But when I guess I say I was extremely high functioning, a lot of people didn't know. A lot of people didn't notice. I went to a lot of meetings drunk and people didn't know, because I think my drunk exuberance is so close to my natural everyday personality that people just don't quite pick up on it. And I had a partner in the UK who told me outright in a very casual conversation, oh, well, it's because you're an alcoholic. And I, you know, clutched at my pearls and gasped like, how dare, like, you don't know, and just kind of tried to brush it off. And he said, well, I don't know anyone else that comes home from work after a midnight shift and puts a straw in a bottle of wine and has that before they go to bed. And I was like, well, that's my wine nap. Like, you know, it was so normal for me. And especially living in the UK, when on one side of my house was an off license that sold two bottles of wine for £6. And on the other side of my door was a newsagent that sold 3 litres of cider for £3. So I was, even on the minimum wage that you earn in the UK, it is so easy to spend it on alcohol, and it's so accessible, and there's no tax, and there's very little responsible service of alcohol. So it is very heavy all the time. And I didn't work, I didn't drive. And because I didn't drive, in my mind, that meant, oh, well, you can be drunk all the time because you'll never have to drive anywhere. Yes, I lived in complete chaos. And I guess having someone who loved me and saw me tell me outright to my face in a very casual, matter-of-fact way that I had a drinking problem, that's kind of re-stirred that pot that I guess was always simmering. And I didn't really get any better at all, until I was about 26 and I met that person.
So obviously you're realizing it's a problem. People are pointing it out to you.
Yeah.
Did you try to stop? Did you have mornings where you go, oh, so you didn't even try to stop? Why?
I didn't care enough about myself to try to stop. Something that I realized in the end of addiction and in the early days of sobriety that I honestly never would have guessed is that I had a lot of self-esteem issues and I had a lot of self-loathing issues. And I didn't know that because I had put on this mask of portraying a confident, charismatic, happy person for so long that when the drinking finally stopped and reality kind of set in, I did realize that I was sad and there was a lot of things that I didn't like about myself, and I behaved in a way for so long that I didn't like. It's still really sad. I still feel really sad for all of the people that I, you know, hurt or inadvertently was a menace around. I was having fun. I was having fun. And I think I kept validating it by saying, well, my behavior doesn't hurt anyone but me. So if I want to hurt myself, that's on me. I looking back now, I can so clearly see that it was a form of self-harm. But I didn't look at it like that. I looked at it as self-care. You know, it's my drink. I need it. I'm just looking after myself. I have done the occasional Dry July as a fundraising trope. And I've always, you know, demanded medals and things at the end of that month and really struggled through it. But the thing is, at the end of that month, you know, the first thing I would do would buy an oversized novelty wine glass that is, you know, 30 centimeter thing, and then have a party to end Dry July. And then the whole cycle starts all over again. And I think doing those Dry July or those months here and there over the years, in my mind, quote unquote, proved that I didn't have a problem. Because see, I did it. I did it for a month. I can do it. I just don't want to. It's a classic trope that I'm sure you've heard many times.
Yeah, absolutely. So this degree of self-loathing, really, which was showing up for you, which that's, you know, it's pretty full on where you, that you just like, I'm getting so fucked up, but I don't care.
Yeah.
I don't care enough about myself to change.
Yeah.
Where did that, like, is it okay to ask where that came from?
Absolutely. Yeah. And it took me a really long time to figure it out. And I think as with so many people in addiction or with ill mental health, so many of these things come back to our childhood. I always thought that I didn't deserve to be upset or hurt about my childhood because it wasn't quote unquote bad enough. I had parents that said they loved me. I had parents that put a roof over my head and sent me to good schools and encouraged my extracurricular activities. It wasn't until I started therapy and sought professional guidance that they helped me see that while I did have all of those things, I didn't have a parent who asked if I was okay. I didn't have a parent who nutritionally looked after me or made sure that I had meals at regular times. I didn't have a parent who said they were proud of me. And there's a whole slew of things that go along with that. And through my healing and through therapy, I can now wholeheartedly say that I forgive my family for everything that they ever inadvertently did to me, because I absolutely wholeheartedly believe they did the best that they could with the information that they had from the experience that they had had and that they had grown from. And I don't begrudge them that at all. But this is probably the first time I can ever say that. If you had asked me this a year ago, I would have still been very hurt and very angry and still feeling like I needed an apology and like I needed them to recognize what had happened. But I accept that that may never happen and that cannot stand in the way of my recovery. It cannot, because I cannot wait around for people who are not ready to see themselves.
Yeah. And also there comes, I guess, through this work and through this realization of, okay, recognizing that there was trauma there, but also realizing that we can't actually change the past and people are just showing up with their own traumas and they're doing the best they can, as you say. But what we can start to do now is to recognize when we're being triggered by our past in our present and how we can take responsibility or how we can tend to whatever's showing up for us in a really healthy way that we can support ourselves and get ourselves through that.
I talk to my inner child out loud on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And when I think you first start to hear about that concept, the inner child work, it can sound a little bit hippy dippy. You know, even I know I've rolled my eyes at the concept before, but you catch yourself doing it all the time, or at least I did, where I would say, oh, I'm so stupid, or I'm so careless. And I would repeat these things that had been told to me in childhood. And I realized that as I'd gone on through life, I'd genuinely come to believe those things. And so now I will catch myself saying it and I go, no. And I stop with everything I'm doing. And I start, and out loud, I say, no, Tash, that's not being very nice to yourself. We all have bad days, or I'll talk myself through whatever the situation is out loud. I don't have to do it in a mirror. I don't have to film it or anything, but that is my habit now of no, Tash. I stop, I reevaluate, I say it out loud. And oftentimes I'm right.
And when things are showing up, it's really important to be able to tune in to that inner child and realize what they would have needed at that time. So if you're being triggered, if you're not feeling loved perhaps in a moment and you're feeling really triggered from that, okay, tuning in and, like I say, tending to that part and saying it's okay, you know, you are loved, and almost speaking to yourself like you are. Yes. I can almost sense the eye rolling going on, but it really does work, because we need kind of learn to love whatever shows up. And it's often our wounds that are showing up when we're having the big emotional response. And where does that come from? And how old is that? And how, you know, and I think a really great practice too is really working on realizing what you would have needed. You know, what you would have needed when you were younger. What did you need to hear back then? And can you supply those words for yourself now?
Yes.
And working on those statements of, I don't know, affirmation, personal love statements that you needed to hear then.
Yes.
And you supply it for yourself. It's very healing work.
It is. And it can certainly, I think, feel embarrassing at the beginning when you're not used to that kind of thing. And I think the reason it can feel embarrassing is because I know I'm like this. I have a hard time accepting compliments because for a long time I didn't believe them. And someone would compliment me and my initial reaction would be, oh, I fooled you too. Like, I'm so disappointed that even you couldn't see that I'm a monster, you know? But that's not true. And I know that about myself now. And you're so right. When I'm having a big cry or something, I will talk to myself and I just go, it's okay, Tash, you're okay. Like, nothing is actually happening, but it's all right to have big feelings. And I'll just tend to my wounds and I've grown through it. And the way I can handle those triggers and those upsets now is just so much better than it ever has been. And I'm excited because I know I'm only going to get better and better and better and learn more skills and put more tools in my tool belt, and it'll just keep getting easier.
Absolutely. And when we have a high degree of self-loathing, which I think a lot of big drinkers do have, and that's probably why they ended up in that situation, really recognizing when that self-loathing is showing up. I was talking to one of my coaching people yesterday and I was just saying, how is your relationship with yourself going at the moment? She's like, nah, it's still not good. Like, it's not good. And I'm like, what's going on? What do you say to yourself? And she's like, well, I call myself a see you next Tuesday.
Yeah.
Wow, that's big, strong words to speak about yourself. And
yeah,
you know, what makes you feel like you're that? You know, what part of you tells you that you're that? And tuning into that part. So we're going on a tangent here, but
no.
Yeah, like understanding that's showing up, and okay, what does that part need to hear that's calling yourself?
Yes. Right? Yes. And who called you that? Yeah. To start off with, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And trying to change that. So I've been working, I just was doing this practice this morning with myself of this sort of hello beautiful practice. So I'm just like, I know this sounds so eye-rolly and cringy as well, but just waking up and reminding myself that I'm beautiful, not in a conceited way, but my insides, my innards are beautiful.
Your energy,
And looking at all the parts of my body. So this is a good practice for people listening. And like looking at my hands and going, wow, you are amazing hands. Like what beautiful, amazing hands at work. And looking at different parts of my body.
Absolutely.
And tuning in. It's such a great practice, Tash, because it's almost like you can feel this sort of zap of energy.
Energy, yes.
And I was reading, I can't remember what book I was reading, but the author was talking about when we don't love all of our parts and love all the bits of our body will end up sending it. Now, this might be too woo-woo for some people, but our body might send us sickness and illness to go, I want some attention.
I believe that. Absolutely. Yeah, body knows best. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a controversial concept, but it's an interesting one. And so sending all of our body love.
I actually, this is relevant. I actually, when I stopped drinking, I was diagnosed with a connective tissue disorder that I had been masking my whole life with alcohol. So many of the symptoms are being clumsy. It's called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, and basically all of the connective tissue in my body is faulty. So right from my eyeballs, my teeth, my gums, all the way from top to toe. I had a little accident. Actually, this is so, you know, when people talk about how did you get sober, I was sober for approximately 2 or 3 weeks before I had an accident that I came off the balcony, my foot came away from my leg, and I was put on heavy, heavy endone and opiates for like a 6-month period.
Hang on. What do you mean your foot came away from your leg?
Like internally it came away. Oh. It just completely disjointed itself. So almost like a dislocation, but the bones broke in the process as well. So through the healing process, basically, I again was put on all these opiates, and so I was trying to go through the feelings of early sobriety, but was heavily medicated, so I couldn't see clearly. Time was a construct. It was all very difficult. But as I sort of came off the medication and started to get into physical therapy, it was a long process, but they realized I had this Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And what's the cure? There's no cure. You have to look after yourself. Looking after myself was a foreign concept. So it actually kind of went hand in hand with recovery. Like, okay, I have to look after myself in an alcohol-free way, but I now actually also have to look after the body. And I'd never given myself, my body, any attention before, any awareness. I would just let it bash into things. I was always falling and tripping and because I didn't care. And I think there was a part of me that was like, maybe I want to fall over and break my whole face open. Maybe I would love a couple of days in hospital, you know, like that sickness that addiction gives you. You know, maybe I want to get hit by a truck. You don't know me, that kind of feeling. And then once I started to get mentally better, I could feel the pain that I had been masking all these years. And I, at the beginning of sobriety, it took me a good couple of years until I could get a proper diagnosis and proper specialists and the right medication to kind of see me through. And I had to learn to walk again from scratch. And now I roller skate. And now I, you know, much more able-bodied than I was, but I understand that I will still be disabled and live in chronic illness for my whole life. And that's okay, because I have that knowledge now, and with that knowledge comes power. I know I can do Pilates. I know I can take these supplements. I know I can do this physio to help myself. And so now I get to look at my legs and I go, yes, legs, you are strong and you carry this body around for me. Yes, hands, you create the most beautiful artwork. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And that practice of loving my body and loving what it can do for me and being so grateful, and my body rewards me for it. You know, I put the good food in, I put the right meds in, I do all the things, and it hurts less and it gets stronger. Mm-hmm. And it's so, it's that all goes so hand in hand for me with recovery. It's all enmeshed together.
I think that's just so beautiful. And for everyone listening, I think give that a go, like today, at some point after hearing this,
yes, please.
You know, after you jump off, go through all of your body and notice too, especially if you, when the ego shows up, when it tries to say, don't say that about your bum, bum's big. Just try and break through that and go, no, my bum is wonderful. It provides cushioning for me when I sit down. It powers my legs to keep me, you know, see it in that way of, wow, look at it. It functions. And even if
strong
it is
strong glutes, we love it.
Yeah. And even if you are if you've got a disability, then okay, let's see what, you know, what is still working. It's really a beautiful thing. And see how that feels in the body to receive that and watch how the ego does show up to try and go, nah. And that's just, you can just be curious with that. Interesting.
It's fascinating, isn't it?
So that's really fascinating too, that you have got this kind of self-loathing and then you get a diagnosis with something that tells you that you're faulty.
Yes. But it, you know what though? Like it was almost like I knew it. I knew that there was something wrong. And I think this was as well part of why it was hard for me to come to terms with my addiction. My parents raised us in very much a walk it off household, you know, and I'm partly so grateful for that because I have such a thick skin and I'm confident in so many, you know, situations out of my comfort zone because of that, you know, mentality. So I'm very grateful for that. However, growing up, I would have frequent, you know, knee dislocations or finger dislocations or these nosebleeds that would go for hours and all of these symptoms. They were symptoms, but nobody wanted to hear me and nobody believed me. And I was always told I was a hypochondriac and I was the drama queen and I was overreacting. And because I was constantly fed that information, when it was time to get sober, I was like, oh, you're a drama queen. Oh, you're overreacting. Oh, you're doing it for attention. And I told myself those things over and over. And it took a long time to learn that that wasn't true and that it's okay to just, this is how I am. And that's okay. Like, even if my body is faulty in all of those ways, it can still do so much and it still lets me do so much. And I will continue to work on my body and keeping it strong so that I can continue to do the best I can do.
Absolutely. And also when we're given messaging that no, what you're feeling or what you're trying to convey to us is wrong, then we start to question our own. Like we question ourselves.
Yes.
Can I really trust myself? And then when feelings come up, we don't know how to handle them. So we go to drink.
Well, it was the same being 18 and being so sure that I was unwell, but having all of my friends tell me, no, you're a party girl. You're fine. Oh, maybe I am fine. Maybe I am being over dramatic. Like it just put so much self-doubt to someone who already had such a lack of self-awareness. It put so much self-doubt in the mix. And so then further down the line, when people did sort of say, oh, do you really want that drink? Oh, do you really want this? I had the excuses ready. Oh, I'm a party girl. Oh, I'm this. Oh, I'm that. Like, I just regurgitated the things that I'd heard and just spat them back at other people as excuses. It was, yes, funny in hindsight.
Yeah. Okay. And so you in comes someone who says to you into your life, oh, you don't actually have to drink alcohol. And you're like, what?
Absolutely.
Hang on, light bulb moment. Tell us about then what followed after that, after hearing that.
Well, I hadn't actually realized on that date that I drank a whole bottle of wine and that they hadn't had a drop, because I was so in my own world that I didn't even notice if other people were drinking or not. Wow. I just, you know, so I drank the whole thing, and it wasn't until the end of the date where I actually went to pour into that and they went, no, I don't drink. And I went, oh my God, since like an hour ago, since when? And they're like, since this whole night, you know, like since the last couple of years. I was like, what?
Wow.
So I drank this. I hadn't even noticed. And then the next morning, and at this point, my body, as you said, was sending me very clear signals that it had had enough alcohol. I was getting alcohol poisoning every single time I drank, whether it be a bottle or six bottles. And I've had alcohol poisoning multiple times now, and I can't believe I just accepted that as part of life.
How did that look for you, the alcohol poisoning?
Drooling, not being able to control my the functions of my mouth, really, like drooling, getting a lot of what I call the mouth sweats, like pre-vomit, but then you never actually throw up. I would slur my words. I wouldn't be able to remember words, like real heavy brain fog. I would have involuntary twitches. So maybe my arm would quickly slap away, or my leg would frantically twitch. And, you know, that's your body's trying to keep yourself alive, trying sending synapses all through your body. Oh, keep it together. Like, you're dying here. I would throw up this yellow foamy bile every half hour for about 9 hours every time.
While you were drinking or after?
After I was, well, like, I would stop drinking because these symptoms would set in, and I would start to go, I don't feel great. I can't get off the floor, or actually I'm going to be sick. And then it would just spiral. And so that had happened the last three consecutive times that I had drunk. So in the last like week. And then I met this person, got the light bulb moment, ding, ding. Next morning, the symptoms of alcohol poisoning, the very unwell, the shaking, all of the things, and anxiety, what I call anxiety, when your regular anxiety is just multiplied by a million. And I was like throwing up in the bathroom. I was like, nope, this has to stop. Like, this is done. Like, I am done. It's also fascinating. At that time, I had just been misdiagnosed actually, with hemochromatosis, which is a blood disorder with too much iron. It turns out it was not too much iron that my body was naturally producing. I was ingesting so much ferritin from the red wine that I was giving myself blood poisoning, like through the amount of iron that I was ingesting. You know, over 4 years sober now. My last blood test was a few weeks ago, and my ferritin is still high. Over 4 years later, I'm still detoxing those effects. Like, I still sleep terribly. I've got many health conditions related to my constant abuse of alcohol through my developmental period. And people have to realize that. Like, it might all be fun and games when you're a teenager, you know, but you have no idea how you can ruin your life. Like, those times that I was, you know, maybe actively trying to harm myself, real harm could have happened to me, and it could have taken my life from all of those around me, and it or damaged my life in a way that is irreparable. And we don't think about those things enough. It's so easy to just think that a couple of drinks is a couple of drinks, but to the wrong person, a couple of drinks can be life-changing and life-wrecking.
Oh, absolutely. And like you say, in that developmental stage of life, like, we don't realize the amount of damage that's doing. Oh. Lissy Turner was on probably about a month ago talking about the effects it has on the endocrine system, on the hormones when teenagers are drinking. And it was really quite scary, like, wow. And some of it's irreparable.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's actually very sad to me. The person that I would say I started my alcoholism journey with, is also an alcoholic still. This is my first, you know, bad boy that I met in high school. So we have been in each other's lives since we were 13. We're both in our 30s now. I'm 4 years sober. He is, for the first time in his life, trying to get sober. And it's very sweet, and he credits me as an inspiration to that, because, you know, if Tash can do it, we've been through the same trenches, we were there together, what's my excuse, you know? And and he's certainly not having the same time of it as me, and I wholeheartedly believe so much of that is to do with the damage done to his brain in during those puberty times. Like, he always drank and did a lot more other substances as well, and I can see the way we've grown up, I can see the way that that's contributed to his development, and I wonder what both of our lives might have been like had we not chosen, or not, it's not a choice, but had we not fallen into addiction at such a young age, I wonder where we both might be. And it's okay to grieve that past, but I try not to dwell on it too much, because I just think the only way is forward, you know, like a shark, always forward, never back, just keep going. You can accept that it happened, but as you said earlier, there's nothing you can do. So you just have to keep going.
Keep going and learn what we can. Yeah. And try and change.
Exactly right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So you're on the bathroom floor. You're like, fuck yes. This is enough.
Stop.
Yeah. Tell us how you stopped. How did you quit?
I know it sounds so easy, but I just stopped. I had a big conversation with my sister about it. We were living together at the time, and I said, I'm going to stop. Can you help me? So we did things like removed the minibar that we had set up in the kitchen. You know, I asked if she was going to drink, could she drink in her room, or could I not sit? Could you not leave the cans out? We removed triggers, or things that we thought were triggers, It was only kind of into the first few months of recovery that I was like, oh, I'm the trigger. It's me. I'm the problem. But learning that, you know, is also powerful. Yeah. And it was really frantic, because I sort of started this sobriety journey, broke my foot so badly, and opened a brand new business all within a 3-month period. So there was just so much going on all the time that I think I just replaced. I always loved to work, but I definitely replaced alcoholism with being a workaholic. And I just filled every spare second of space with a job or hanging out with someone or doing something. Like, no downtime was allowed, because downtime meant I had time to think, and that meant I thought I would regress and I might relapse. So no time to think, just keep doing. Don't give yourself any time to stop. And then I broke my leg and I had to stop. But also I was plied with all of these drugs. And so all of the thoughts that I was having were not clear. They weren't coming from a really sensical place. But it was hard not to believe that at the time. And then happens with so many people, I realized that the people that I had surrounded myself with were not my friends. They were just people that would drink with me. And I started to see a lot of dysfunction in my friends. And what was interesting and very sad is that the people in my life who struggled with dysfunction did not want to see me happy. They did not want to see me well. And I lost truly almost everyone, because there's very, very few people that I can count on one hand, people that I have in my life still from who knew me when I was drinking, because so many were just randoms. And I think I intentionally chose people who couldn't really see me so that I could get away with this bad behavior, and so that I could behave in this way and not be called out by it, because I chose people who wouldn't do that. And a lot of those people are still, you know, in their dysfunction, they're still unwell because they're not ready to get happy. And I'm glad that we moved on and are no longer friends. But it was, yeah, the first 6 months of it were very awful and very confusing. And I also thought I could do it alone. So I didn't really tell anyone. I didn't come out publicly as having a problem or being sober until I had made it to 1 year. Again, I understand why I did this now. It was the fear of being perceived as a failure, or the fear of being perceived as an attention seeker, or the idea that people, and now I struggle with the idea that people don't understand how bad it really was, because I'm so quote unquote young. I think people assume, oh, you were just, you know, spent a few nights, few many too late nights at the club. And I was like, no, like, it was all day, every day for like a decade. So yeah, it was just about finding the right counselors, finding the right real friends, and being open and honest with everyone around me about my needs. That's very scary. It probably took me 2 years before I could actively voice what I needed without guilt or without shame.
When you say that, like voicing your needs, can you give us an example of voicing your
needs? It could be so small. It could be, hey, mate, do you have time for a FaceTime chat? Or it might be, hey, are you doing dinner tonight? Could I come over for dinner? Like, I don't have the spoons to cook, or I don't want to order anything. Or it could be, hey, I'm doing a job on the weekend. Is there any way you could help me bump in? I don't want to carry XYZ by myself. And they're very small examples.
It's just reaching out
in any way. Like, I took on every single responsibility in mine and others. And I took that on all myself, as, you know, I felt it was my job, as I'd sort of been trained to do as the older sibling, you know. And now, again, I'm reparenting myself. Like, what do I need? What would make this easier? And, you know, when I may be crying, I kind of go through a checklist. I go, do I need like sensory situations? So I do I need a hot shower, or do I need to lay in the sun? Do I need to go roller skating? Or is it a personal thing? Do I need to make a phone call? Or sometimes I just need to make a voice note. I don't even need to speak to someone on the other end. I just need to have a place, a safe place where I can talk about my feelings with no fear of judgment. And I might even end my voice note with, I don't even need you to respond, mate. I just needed to vent this. And then my friends will always respond anyway, and will always reaffirm how I feel and give fantastic advice. And I have friends around me now who will tell me no, and who tell me when I'm wrong, and who tell me when I'm getting a bit too chaotic. And I have never needed that more than I need it in recovery. So I am so grateful that I have real, real, real friends now. It's, yeah, something very, very special.
Yeah, there's something really important too and potent in expressing what you need or asking for help if you need it. I mean, it makes all the difference. Tell me, did you have physical withdrawals at the start because you were drinking such an extreme amount?
Yeah, I got really sick. It was almost like having the flu for maybe like a good month or so. I was just constantly run down and unwell and nauseous. I couldn't really make sense of it too much. And I guess I didn't realize what was necessarily happening. But I would throw up most mornings. I was very, very irritable with everyone around me all of the time. And I had this thing, you know how people say they get hangry, and when they can't have food, I would get like that, but with alcohol. And I would be in someone's house, and if they don't offer me a drink within like the first couple of minutes, I start to get really antsy. And I'm like looking around the room. I'm like, where do you keep your wine? Like, where's your wine fridge though? Like, when are you going to get me a drink? and so then in early recovery, I was looking for something, but I never knew what. And so I was just antsy all the time. I was just furious all the time. And then I was filled with rage and jealousy at anybody who could drink. So I had to stay off Instagram basically, because if I saw a story of someone out drinking, I was so angry at them because it wasn't fair. And like, oh, look at you being able to have a normal drink. How great for you. Like, it's so silly.
Were you able to switch that perspective to eventually look at it in the opposite way? Yeah,
definitely. And absolutely. Now I see people who have had a couple of drinks. I'm like, wow, that's amazing that you can stop at just 3 drinks. That's wow. It fully baffles me. But then I see other people and I'm like, oh, you're not well. Like, I'm so sorry. Like, I hope that you feel better, you know, but this performative alcohol party thing you're doing, like, it's only for your benefit. Like, nobody believes this. So, and I'm sure nobody believed me in my situation either. I'm sure there were people that could see straight through me. Bartenders, I know certainly could. I remember being turned away many times at, like, you know, before midday, being like, why don't you go back to the office? Or like, why don't you, like, maybe you shouldn't have Sambuca shots at 11 in the morning. And I'm, oh, you know, and it was always those times that I would get angry at the bartender. Don't you want my money? Isn't this your job? Like,
so how silly. Did you tend to that anger when it was showing up, when you were feeling that resentment towards people that were still drinking?
In early days, I turned it in on myself. And that's what helped me realize that was a pattern, that I did that regularly. So I would get angry at others. And then I would say, the only reason you're angry is because you're so stupid and you can't handle it. And you're the reason you fucked up. You're mad at yourself. And then I would just internalize it. And it wasn't until I learned so much more about how to speak to myself and how to love myself that I could actually say, no, that's not true. actually what's happening is you're being triggered right now by past behaviors. And maybe you feel a little bit ashamed of your past behaviors, watching them in somebody else. That's okay too. And again, it's just, that's okay. The best bit of therapy that I ever learned that changed my world was the concept of it can be both. Such a simple concept, but I truly lived my life in black or white. It was good or bad. I was right or wrong. My feelings, and that's why I would get so confused. I was like, well, I have this negative feeling about this person or this situation, but I also have this positive. So the negative must be wrong, because that's my experience in life, that the negative is always correct. And then this person said, you know, it can be both. You can be angry at people for having this control that you don't have, while still having empathy and self-love and understanding for yourself.
It's so, thank God you got therapy that you were able to see that. And it's so true that you can be pissed off, or you can grieve the fact that I can't, you know, I'm not doing that anymore. And that's okay. Like, you can have the both. Absolutely. And it
I use it every day, and I often use it with my friends. You know, my friends will say, oh, I'm really grieving my ex-partner, and I'm grieving them, and I love them so much, but also they weren't very nice to me, and I think that it's the right thing that we're not together. And I was like, it could be both. Both of those things can be true and exist simultaneously. That it might seem like such a simple concept to some people listening, but to me it was a world-changing and something that I'd never, just like being sober, it was something that I'd never considered before, the fact that there could be two truths simultaneously.
Yeah. Well, I think simplicity is best. You know, it's often those simple kind of little messages that we get that we're like, oh, that makes sense. Okay, that hits home for me. Because,
yes,
yeah, we don't really want complex issues to deal with our already complex, complex explanations to deal with our complex issues. I guess it would make it really difficult. Okay. And so what about with just like, because it was such a big part of you, that was like big part of your identity, how was that also like letting go of the friends and letting go of this person that you saw yourself as being, you know, and this crutch that you had for so long? How was that?
Sad and lonely, like really lonely for a really long time, because it's hard to find true friends and true community when you're not sure on yourself. That can make it extra challenging. So for a long time, I felt very isolated, and I felt like no one could possibly understand. And I tried my best to find community in AA, and it just wasn't for me. It wasn't for me. I found that I went looking for people to relate to, and I felt lonelier than ever, because it was either people who had been through what I deemed to be so much worse than what I'd gone through. And in the early days, there was so much a part of, oh, well, I'm not sick enough. I'm not bad enough. I haven't had a divorce or a death in the family or a near miss life experience. I haven't been to war. I don't have PTSD from Vietnam. I don't deserve to be drunk. What am I complaining about? You kind of see all these other people and hear all these other experiences, and it's so easy to belittle yourself and put your feelings down. And even I tried a women's group, and again, everyone was much older than me, and their problems were not my problems. Their problems were about their husbands or their families or their kids and their schedules. And I was like, but don't you hate yourself because you're alive? And it was just very difficult. And even then I tried the LGBT kind of communities, and I found even then it was like I didn't quite fit in, because so many of the issues around addiction for this particular community also go hand in hand with gender identity or homophobia or abuse and experiences, you know, so many experiences that can affect the queer community. And I felt like I, again, didn't have a right to be there. Like I didn't fit in enough to kind of warrant healing. It was the same way I didn't want to get sober originally. I didn't feel like I deserved love. I didn't deserve to be healed. So I heard of something called Smart Recovery, which you've probably heard of. I've tried diligently to find a meeting, to find a representative, and I've not had very much luck. So that's when I really turned to kind of doing the work myself. So I found podcasts that I liked. I would take recommendations from those podcasts. I would do a lot of online reading. I would find forums. I would talk to people in the community online. I just kind of built this community around me that felt right for me, that it didn't have to be you know, AA, or it didn't have to have a title, you know, it didn't have to be a way of doing recovery. It was just what I was doing, what was working for me. I made a group chat and I put all of the important people in there who I wanted to share my journey with. And every milestone, I sent a little picture, or every time I was having a hard day, we came up with an emoji system. So all I had to do was send an emoji. I didn't have to be vulnerable or tell anyone that I was hurting or what was going on. I just sent this one emoji. It was like Morse code, and everyone in my circle knew that if they had the capacity to, I could really use some support. And that was a really gentle way of breaking me into asking for what I wanted. And now I definitely have the skills, and they'll keep growing forever. But it was, little things like that, forming things that worked for me, the podcast especially. I find so helpful hearing other people's stories, because I often relate so much more to guests on podcasts than I do strangers in a room.
Absolutely. I love that, building your own community and just building your own recovery. Like, you absolutely built it yourself. I can relate to that, because that's exactly what I did.
Yeah.
And I think that's so wonderful. Okay. And so 4 years, 3 months down the track, you know, look at you. You're just absolutely gorgeous, and you're vibrant and amazing.
I feel it.
Yeah. When did that turn for you? When did you start to feel that vibrancy come back?
Do you know what? And this is ironic. It's actually when I left the person I got sober with. So, and I don't really want to discuss their story too much. It's quite sad for me, but we basically parted ways. And at the time we parted ways, they relapsed immediately and have not been able to get back on the bandwagon. That was very heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. I've just lost a partner, but I've also lost hope. I've lost hope in sobriety. Like, I've lost hope that, oh, well, it's okay, because if I fall off the wagon, my friends will rally around me. And I watched this happen to this person, and I was like, how are your friends just letting you do this? It's common knowledge. It is fact that you are an alcoholic, that you need to be in recovery. I can't believe that all of your quote unquote friends are letting you drink. And I was like, that could happen to me. And it just turned into another selfish thing of, that could be me. I could relapse and no one would do anything about it. And I have the capacity to ruin my life again. And that's terrifying, really scary. And that's still something, a big issue. The idea of relapse out of my control terrifies me. But when I split with this person, that's when I had realized that I had inadvertently, in the process of healing, so much of my being and my wellness into their wellness. And if they were well, I was well. And if they were unwell, then I would do anything, whether it's to my detriment or not, to make that person feel better again. And I became very codependent, and it's very, very clear in hindsight, leaving that codependent relationship, living on my own for the first time, buying my own car, doing absolutely everything for myself, by myself, for myself, made me see love, made me see that I'm worth doing it for, that I'm so special. And I have all of these amazing, wonderful qualities, and boo-hoo to the people that don't get to see them, you know, like, too bad, because I'm thriving. As you said, I really do feel like I'm thriving. And every milestone that comes up, I go, oh, 4 years, the rest of my life to go. And I'm excited about that. Whereas the first few, I was like, oh my God, 1 month down, 1 million to go. And it's so daunting and impossible feeling. But now I'm so excited, and I can't wait to, you know, be like, I've got Peter Ann, who's actually the person that introduced Libby and I together. She is one of my sober icons. She just reached 14 years sober. She is a phenomenal entrepreneurial woman, mother, politician. Like, she's fantastic. And she has held my hand through every step of the way. And having, again, people in an adult position tell you that you can do it, and that I've been in your position, and look at me now. It's a huge inspiration.
Yeah, that's amazing. It's great to have that, a mentor or someone that's there to sort of go, yep, you can do this. You've got this. Yeah.
I think it goes hand in hand with why AA's people have sponsors. It makes so much sense having someone to be able to connect to like that. So yes, Libby and Peter Ann are certainly what I consider my unofficial sponsors. And I know for a fact that if I was ever in a place where relapse was even a remote possibility, that speaking to those two people alone would be enough to sort it out. So I'm very confident in that.
Yeah, that's incredible. Amazing. So tell us a bit about what you're doing now and like your shop your art. Yeah. Like, tell us a bit about that.
Well, I kind of think I accidentally did this to build the community that I was looking for, again, completely inadvertently. I am an artist. I work with wearable art, strange things, just unexpected, unusual. I've always kind of had that practice of being mixed media, jumping from style to style, very eclectic, and I just make what I feel. The most important part of what I do is the community work that I do. So I work with queer youth, I work with disengaged and disabled youth, and that's really what gives me the most passion. That's what drives what I do, because I get to see people like me from when I was that age, and they're all in a room. And sometimes I'll have a room full of disengaged youths who maybe haven't finished high school for whatever reason. And they'll kind of come in and they'll be grumpy, and they tell me that they can't and that they won't, and that they're bad at this, and that they're not creative, and they're so negative. And we will do these beautiful, uplifting team building workshops, creative thinking workshops. And we make up, if the only thing you make is a mess here, that that's still a good time. And then I watch the development in these kids, and I watch the way that they start to open up, and the way they start to talk, and the way their brains start to creatively put things together a little bit differently. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, by the end of the workshop, we're all smiling and we're all laughing and we're all coming up with these crazy concoctions. And watching that is like watching magic happen. You're watching people find community. You're watching people overcome their, you know, self-esteem issues or their things that they think they can't and they won't. And then they see that they can and they will and they should. So if I can just sort of inspire people just to make art for the sake of mental health, you know, just to have some downtime, take an hour out of your week and do some collaging, like the world will keep turning. Those emails will still be there, but you will have taken an hour out to just do something calming. And maybe you make a silly little picture and maybe you make nothing, but you've taken time out for you. And I do that a lot with adults as well, with our adult workshops. I'm frequently reminding people, take time out. But it's I feel like I'm a very privileged situation. I especially get to see so many queer youth who are more inspiring than ever before. And I'm excited for the future. And I guess my community is predominantly like queer, neurodiverse, disabled youth. And they laugh in the face of adversity. You know, they have this language that we never even could have dreamed of. And the way they know themselves, can express themselves, the confidence they have, this is generally speaking, but it is astounding. And it gives me so much hope, because I see the way they talk and care for each other. And I was like, hopefully we are working towards a world where, you know, sobriety is not a taboo subject and alcoholism is not a shame anymore. It can just be a disease that you have and you work on getting better. It doesn't have to be something that you did to yourself. Sometimes these things happen to us and that's okay too. So I guess what I'm doing is trying to just spread joy and creativity and as much color as I possibly can while being super authentic to myself at all times. And like I said, recovering out loud, I want to talk about it and I want to talk to people about it.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. I love what you do. I think it's such a beautiful thing to do, and getting people into that space of just being creative just for the hell of it. You know, it doesn't matter, or if you don't even come up with something, that's fine, but just have fun in the process. Yeah. It's beautiful to be able to lean into that creative side. Going back, if you could speak to 14-year-old Tash, what would you say to her? What advice would you give her?
Oh my God, that's too sad. That's such a sad question. God, I don't know. I would just want her to have space to feel. I feel really emotional. It's really sad. So I did childhood modeling. So from the age, like from when I was old enough to kind of walk and talk, I did like modeling school. And so they teach you like how to talk and how to walk and how to present yourself and how to be. So as a neurodiverse person, if you put me in a room and then somebody gives you step-by-step instructions on how to fake be a person, I just copied that and just put it in place for my whole childhood and was like, okay, well, these are the rules of how to be a person. I'll just do those. So I don't wish that I hadn't had that experience, because it changed me, it molded me. But I wish I had had space at home or a social space or at school to be authentically myself. I think that I feel like I was acting from a very young age, and that comes with, you know, being neurodiverse. But I just, the only space that I felt myself was when I was alone in my room with a drink, you know, and I felt like I was reaching into my inner feelings and I would feel quote unquote deeper when I was drinking, but actually you're just getting depressed. Like you're actually just becoming sad. But yeah, I don't know, 14-year-old Tash, I would just want to tell her that you, the way you are and the things that you're hiding don't need to be hidden. Like, yeah, I just wish I could have been as authentic as I am now my whole life. I just wish that. And I want that for younger generations as well. Just it can be hard to be yourself when you're younger. You know, kids are fucking cruel as well. I was bullied all through primary school. Like there's so many layers, you know, as to why I am the way I am. But having yeah, authentic space just to be myself would have made the world of difference for me. Sad.
Yeah, beautiful. All right, well thank you so much. And if people wanted to reach out to you or go, you know, even come and visit you at the shop.
Absolutely. I'm Calamity Tash on everything. Just give it a Google, all my socials, website address, location, hours, all of that stuff will all come up. Amazing. But I'm always up for a sober chat, so if anyone wants to message and reach out and ask for advice or anything like that, I am always up for it. On that note, though, I will say the question that I get asked most regularly throughout my whole recovery has been, how do I confront my friend? How do I make my friend stop? And as you know, you can't make anyone do anything. And I'm sure this is recapped 1,000 times on this podcast and every other one, but you have to have your own aha moment. You can't force it. You can't make it happen. All you can do is support that person and in the most gentle way possible, remind them that you still love them and you still care about them. You're just worried. You know, you're concerned. I think coming at things from a place of concern rather than aggression, of making people change or stop, is always going to go a little bit better. But always up for a chat on the topic.
Yeah, and I think if you're recognizing or seeing that maybe a friend or a loved one has a problem, rather than getting angry with them, just realizing that they are soothing themselves the only way that they know how at this point. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Like, let's ask why these people in your life might be doing these things, not how can we get them to stop, but how did we get to this point, and what can we change about, you know, the way that we interact with them that might make them feel more supported or heard or, absolutely, you know, be able to be listened to. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Tash, you're amazing. Thank you so much for this. I know you're super busy, so thank you for your time today. And
it's been really lovely. It's been a nice reflection, honestly. I don't get enough time to have these kind of self-reflective moments, so I think it's been really valuable for me as well. So thank you so much.
Amazing.
And thank you for all the work you do. This is so important. This kind of content is invaluable to both people in recovery and people thinking about recovery. So congratulations to you, and thank you so much for what you do for the community.
Thanks, Tash. Thank you so much. Brilliant. See ya.
Thank you.
Bye.
See you later.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.